Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Buckets and Tea NBA Show. I'm your host, Katherine Eicher. Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode. Joining me this week, you know him, you love him. He's your buddy, he's your pal. It's Samson Folk. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm just excited to talk some hoops, some comedic values, all that kind of stuff.
I mean, wasn't that so? That was a great intro, right, on my part, because you were like, "Don't tell people what my credits are." You're like, yeah. People just know me, generally speaking.
yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody knows me. Yeah.
But I also do that every time I do a stand-up comedy show. Like, the host will always ask me, like, what do you want me to say? Do you have something to promote? And I'm like, just tell people I'm a perfectly fine person and I'll go up and do my thing. I'm always like, I don't know how to say that kind of stuff. But anyway, so we're going to talk a bunch of NBA, talk about the playoffs, talk about each series that's happening so far. And then we're going to get into a little bit of Raptors trade rumors after that. But first, I got to start with a very weird disclaimer. It came to my attention this morning that some of the Raptors Republic podcasts in the last week have had political ads on them. I've heard a conservative party ad and I think a liberal attack ad. I just want everyone to know that that's a mistake. We actually have like no political ads as like a setting on our podcast feed, but for some reason some of these ads are still filtering through, I guess because it's election season. We're not entirely sure why, but just so people who are listening know that those ads are not necessarily a reflection of Raptors Republic. We are not intentionally trying to be political in any way. I mean, of course, I have my own views. Everybody at Raptors Republic has their own views, and we're not actually trying to have political ads. So you might hear some on this episode. We're working on it. So apologies to people, but just so you know, we're not actually affiliated with any political party and we're not trying to be political.
I was thinking of doing, if I had a green screen, actually it's all blue, but I was gonna put the Angola communist flag behind me, like, the waving, like, as you were saying this, we're not political, okay? And yeah. I was gonna put like Paul Robeson singing the USSR like communist anthem.
Yeah. I just want to take a minute to talk about the People's Party of Canada right now, if you don't mind. Yeah. Anyway, just a very weird thing that's been happening this last week. So just everyone know that that's a very random mistake and we're working on it. Okay. All right. Let's move on to some basketball here. We're recording this on Thursday, May 12th. Last night we had some really great basketball and some really bad basketball. But let's talk about the great game first, the Milwaukee Bucks versus the Boston Celtics. I earlier said that this series was going to be too close to call, which is such a, like, I don't know, flaky thing to say, but it's kind of true when that has turned out to be really true. Jrue Holiday, maybe one of the best defensive plays I've ever seen. Really incredible stuff at the end there. I want to know, Samson, what do you think of this Bucks-Celtics series? Has this gone the way you expected? Has it completely blown you away? Where are you at with this?
I think that the Celtics have been better than I expected, although I still expect the Bucks to win. I expect the Bucks to win the championship. And that was my pick, I think, in like probably from the start of the season. The Bucks have been playing really well. Giannis is unstoppable. He's fully assumed form as the best player in the world, even if that's not recognized in the regular season and the playoffs. They differ somewhat in play style, and like as you said, like having Jrue Holiday as a point of attack defender, it kind of changes the makeup of how teams have to attack. And then you have guys like Brook Lopez and Giannis at the back end, and they have a bunch of other, like a healthy amount of other defenders who come in. Their defense is awesome. We've seen the Celtics struggle against it immensely. And so the Celtics have been better, and Jason Tatum, I think, has been just tremendous. The Al Horford game was super fun. But so the Celtics have impressed me, but they haven't moved me to the point where I would change my prediction. So the Bucks are still doing their thing as far as I'm concerned.
I love that. I love that Al Horford has a game that will live in infamy, the Al Horford game. I feel like Bill Simmons is going to bring it up 10 years from now and expect us to know exactly what he's talking about.
That's what was it? I can't remember. He had a write-up where he was talking about Memphis, and he was talking about how they were down, I think, like 2-0 in a series. And he's like, you can tell. You know, everybody remembers Martin Luther King's assassination here. It hangs over the town. He's like the king.
Wait, this like the old Memphis Grizzlies, like way back?
This is grit and grind.
Yeah, so
this
is
like 2000, I guess, like, yeah, Zach Randolph, Mark, Tony Allen.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, Bill Simmons will always be very comfortable getting on a podcast or getting into a column and being like, this terrible thing that happened. It's basically sports. Everything is sports, bro. And yeah, so I don't know if there's anything hanging over anything anymore, but Bill Simmons just being brought up, I had to tell that one too. God, he's got so many. It's unbelievable.
I love that. There are so many regrettable things that I'm sure he has. Like, that would be such a funny, like, deep dive off-season top 10 list thing to do. I don't know if you've ever read The Book of Basketball, but it opens up with this story of him in Vegas meeting Isaiah Thomas for the first time. And he keeps going on and on about how this particularly large woman looks like in a bikini, and how he was so transfixed, like he couldn't get over it. Why is that in the Book of Basketball?
That's actually something Bill Simmons gets away with this. And there's like these kind of like, there are assumed to be these like folksy terms that, you know, white men use. It's like, oh man, he can operate out of a closet, he can all these different things. And the white male being transfixed on something has occupied a very large part of literature, and so maybe he snuck that in there because he's like, people are used to this, I can just say like, hey, I was really interested by this large woman in a book about basketball, and it just flies, you know.
You made this so much more profound than I thought it would be, but you're absolutely right. Like, I can't disagree with that at all. Anyway, we were talking about the Bucks. Yeah, last week I gotta call myself out. I don't know why I suddenly became a Drew Holiday hater. I just did. I don't know why I did. I like Drew Holiday, but I was just like, I think I even said like, who? Just to be a little Mariah Carey about it. I don't know why. This guy's proven me all the way wrong. I'm very impressed. I'm impressed with the Bucks. Like, I, you know, with Chris Middleton out, I was just like, in my mind, I was like, it's going to be Boston in 6 or Milwaukee in 7, right? Like, they'll either figure it out eventually or they won't figure it out in time. But they seem very comfortable without, as comfortable as you can be without your second best player. And you're right. Like, their defense has been absolutely fantastic. Giannis is playing like the MVP, whether he gets the quote unquote award or not. And actually, I want to talk about that a little bit. I guess it'll come up when we talk about like Sixers Heat. But yeah, like, and like you said, like, he hits another level in the playoffs. They have that experience now where like they've been in these moments before. Although I would say like the Boston Celtics do have some playoff experience at this point as well with this core, but I don't know if they're going to get over this hump right now. I am pro like abolishing the Eastern Western Conference brackets. Like, I want to see a 1-16 because it just, to me, it's like the series after this won't be as good as this one. And I hate that. Not to get ahead of myself, but.
Yeah, that's I'm really glad you brought up hating Drew Holiday, because I love Drew Holiday. But I had this theory that because Drew Holiday is a wife guy, he receives a lot less criticism for his bad games than most people do, because people respect a wife guy. Like, Drew Holiday, he missed like a huge part of an NBA season to care for his wife. He's like this handsome guy who's like, yeah, I just love my wife. On his social media, he posts his pictures of his family. And you know how when somebody on Twitter, if they have a bad game, they post a picture of them and their family and say, this is who you're slandering, by the way. I feel like Drew Holiday was the first guy to install that ethos. So that you're the hater, you're a very strong hater then, because you're working through waves of positive wife guy propaganda to get there. Even though I, even though I love him.
I mean, I know he loves his wife. I did know that much. I believe she's a, she's an athlete.
Yeah.
So I did know that, and I still didn't care.
Yeah.
But I do, but I do care. But it's also like, I don't know. Now I feel like a bad person. I went from just being a casual hater to just being a full on bad person, bad feminist. I don't know.
No, this makes you stronger. This makes you way stronger. You know, the agitprop, you like moved through it. It was no problem whatsoever.
This is so much for me to dissect, like that it's extra hard to hate on a player that loves his wife.
Yeah.
But that just goes to show there's so few who do. Right? That we have to make exception for the few that actually like shout out their wives, right? Because it's like you're saying it like the bar is so low that like Drew Holiday loving his wife is like, oh wow, let's give this guy all the stickers.
Well, yeah, that's what is that? That's like the joke about 90s stand-up comedy is a guy gets up there, he's like, I hate my wife, and everyone's like, yeah, let's go. This guy's, you know. And somebody's like, hey, actually, I like the woman I chose to spend my life with. We're all like, damn, that's pretty impressive. I don't like my wife personally, but I wish I did. So this guy must be a good guy.
Yeah. 2000s, like, female comedy became like, I hate my kids. And then all the women were like, yeah. So that's evolved. There's a comedian based in Toronto, shout out, named Todd Graham. And he has this joke that kills every time. And all it is, Todd Graham's like, I want to say in his 50s, all it is he just stands there and he looks at the crowd and he quietly says, I am attracted to women my own age. And it destroys every time. And I hate it. I love it and I hate it all at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess like there's got to be like a short list of NBA players who love their wives, and I guess I shouldn't hate on those players. But Russell Westbrook loves his wife, and he gets all the hate.
Yeah, but Russell is a very special case. He's like an authoritarian, you know? He's very compelled to protect his own image, even outside. Like, Drew Holiday doesn't have a reputation with the past franchises, be it like Philadelphia or New Orleans, where he was like, don't say this about me, don't ask me these questions, don't whatever. Mm-hmm. But when Russ was in OKC, he very famously had like the media kind of in a chokehold, and the public relations people were like, yeah, just don't do this with Russ. Don't do this. Like, don't do this.
And he hates the media. I don't know why he hates the media so much.
If I was a player, I feel like I wouldn't like the media either. Although it depends on who you're kind of introduced to. Like,
Chris, but it's advantageous not to hate the media.
Yeah. Because if you hate the media, then, you know.
Because it doesn't help. Like, if he had a good relationship with the media, he might even have a bit of a better narrative than he does now.
Probably. Which is a shame. Which means that some people in the media aren't doing a good job. But also, I think Serge Ibaka had the best quote about it, where he said he used to be short with media all the time, and he didn't give them much time. And then he asked a media member how much money they made in a year. And then after that interaction, he decided to be very charitable in his quotes and with his time, because he was like, wow, I'm super rich and you're just like this little working class, you know, schmuck. So I'm going to give you some more time and try and give you good quotes so you can do better stories and stuff like that.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Thoughtful guy.
A surge, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We're so many ways off topic here.
He's on the Bucks, though. So technically, you know, it's tied in.
Okay. Way to bring it back. He's not going to be on the Bucks for long, though.
Probably not. No.
Okay. Do you want to see him on the Raptors again? That's a narrative Serge? I'm seeing around.
I don't think he'd get playing time, which I like. Sorry to say, maybe he's in a kind of like a consultation role on the bench, like the Udonis Haslem Heat role, where maybe he wants to fight somebody on occasion, like his blood boils, and then he's kind of showing everybody how to cook healthy meals too. And that you say like, yeah, we'll keep Serge around. He has excellent vibes. He loves the city. The city loves him. But as far as playing on the Raptors, you see guys like Thaddeus Young, who came into the rotation, is definitely a better player than Serge currently. Chris Boucher is better than Serge currently. And so it'd be tough to imagine him cracking that rotation, especially since the Raptors, everybody who plays for them is guaranteed to play like just an unbelievable amount of minutes and to be per 100 possessions, like lead the league in miles traveled on defensive possessions because you have to fly around everywhere. And Serge doesn't want to do that. He wants to kind of like hang out in the paint right now and try and swat shots away, maybe shoot a couple jumpers on the other end. So in like a very low key role, but I don't think he would play important minutes, unfortunately.
Also, he's too tall now.
Yeah. Yeah. Past the quota.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think like, I just think the sort of demise of Serge's career is pretty heartbreaking. Because he was playing at a fairly elite level, and then this back injury happens, and then it's like suddenly he's like in the G League for a minute, and now he's just like relegated to the bench. It feels like it happened so fast. Like, I think that's more like the heartbreaking part of it, at least for me as a Raptors fan. It's just like, oh, like, I want to believe Serge has more in him, more to give still than he's currently given the opportunity to, but I don't actually know if that's true.
Well, that's, and maybe I'm being a little bit too pessimistic. Maybe there's a late career renaissance or something like that. You never know what kind of shape guys will be able to get their body back to, if they'll be able to recover something they lost. But yeah, you're right. Like, the back injury has completely messed up probably how he envisioned the end of his career, the Twilight version going down. But I guess we'll see. I'd be super happy if he reclaimed a lot of that fluidity and motion that he was, that was emblematic of a huge part of his career. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where would be a good fit for him this year, but he's a free agent, so we'll see where he ends up. Okay, let's move on to the Warriors-Grizzlies. They had an absolute, the Warriors, disastrous game last night. I think they lost by close to 40 points. And, I mean, what happened? What happened to them? Like, my theory is that the Warriors get very complacent. They just do. They have this history of getting very complacent. And I think they just thought they had it in the bag. And they clearly didn't. I do think they'll win game six. I do. I think they will close it out. I think this was an embarrassing enough of a loss that they're going to recover. But I mean, I think this is kind of shitty for me to say, but I think it was more a collapse of the Warriors than it was the Grizzlies being especially great. Not that they weren't great, but you know what I mean? It's like, it's the combination of those two things. I don't think it was just like the Grizzlies just put a huge chokehold on the Warriors.
I think it's an interesting clash of play styles. I think you're correct in that there was some complacency, and especially with Ja out, but the Grizzlies, you know, the stat that floated around in the middle part of the year was like, oh, they're like 11-2 without Ja. And then they finished at 20-5 without Ja. Which is that's a tremendous record, like in basketball. Mm-hmm. That's insane. Mm-hmm. And Ja is a really, really bad defender. And asking him to guard one of like Klay or Steph or Jordan Poole, it compromises your defense constantly. And so when the Grizzlies replace him with a guy like Tyus Jones or DeAnthony Melton, these really great point of attack defenders, it actually completely disrupts and changes how the Warriors want to attack, and where they've been getting to on the floor is no longer a thing. Like, even when the Grizzlies were playing Minnesota, Patrick Beverley, I think on the one game he had 14 drives on Ja and got into the paint 13 times. You know, if that's Drew Holiday, for example, that number might be zero. That's the difference that like a really good and bad point of attack defender makes. And so, even though they lose a ton of offensive punch from Ja leaving, guys like Tyus Jones step up, Kyle Anderson steps up, Jaren Jackson has better driving games and stuff like that. So they have to play a different way, but the Grizzlies are so deep and have so many good players that they can kind of change styles very quickly, and they found success in it. And then that mixed with probably some complacency from the Warriors created the terms and conditions for a game five route, which is pretty cool if you ask me.
Okay, so I get it. The Grizzlies are better without Ja. Got it.
Put it on a graphic.
Yeah. That's good. That's how we're gonna advertise this episode. Yeah. no, but I think you're absolutely right, and they definitely did have a bounce back game. Should Dylan Brooks have been a hockey player? That's my other question for you. Should he have played hockey?
No, because you know you need a guy like Dylan, like his nickname, the Dillest Villain, because it's the illest Dillest? Villain. The Dillest Villain, because it's illest villain, but okay. It's Dylan. Yeah, it's like Joel Embiid in the Raptors series, right? It was super bad. Obviously, unlucky that his orbital bone fractured and all that kind of stuff. But he complained about it, which I disagree with probably his complaints about the Raptors fan base, especially coming from Philadelphia. And he's like, don't swear. It's like, okay, Joel, like, I know you're a troll, but I love Joel Embiid. He's one of the best villains in the NBA because he doesn't care about appealing to other fan bases. He wants Philly to like him. He doesn't want Miami to like him. He doesn't want kids coming up to him on the street wearing a Heat jersey and be like, hey, Joel, he wants to crush their dreams when they're in the stadium. He wants to do the airplane. He wants to like give the finger. He wants to like do all this kind of stuff. And Dylan Brooks, you'll remember him when he was playing the Raptors saying like, this is my house, when they won like a game in the middle of the season.
Yeah.
And like, you need villains in the NBA, the guys who are unafraid to take the optics of seeming like an ass and just kind of like really lean into it. I love that. And so Dylan Brooks, if he was in hockey, we wouldn't get it.
Based on everything you said earlier, if I said to you that I love Dylan Brooks, you'd be like, Catherine, what's wrong with you? He doesn't have a wife that he loves. How dare you?
Well, that's true. I only like guys with wives. You know, it's you want what you can't have, right?
I think last week I was like, there's that uninterrupted clip with him and the other Grizzlies talking about the time they spent in Toronto. And I'm like, where did they go? What did they do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Probably just to like Rutgers or something like that. Played some games.
I doubt that.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, but he's great. I'm glad
he's great. He's Mississauga's own. We're both from Saga, so shout out. But yeah,
did you guys hang out? Did you grow up together?
We did not grow up together.
That's too bad.
But I don't actually know where he went to school or anything. But in any case, I love this Memphis team. But I said this last week. I'm getting sentimental for the Warriors. Like, I just want the Warriors to take it. And I think they will anyways. I mean, this team playing so well without Ja, they did it during the regular season as well. I don't see them winning, even if the Warriors collapse, which I don't think will happen. But even if they did, I don't see them beating the Suns, Mavs, or like making it to the finals or like winning a whole chip without Ja. I don't know. Is that crazy? I don't think that's crazy.
I think it's kind of what we saw happen with Fred in the Raptors series, where the Raptors got to play a different brand. And that was like a change up.
That's a great comparison. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a change up and they got longer. The doubles they sent were, you know, a little bit more effective because there's extra length on the court. Joel Embiid's reads out of doubles changed, you know, like having Fred VanVleet's short arms, as great a defender as Fred is, it just changed the looks. And Pascal was good enough by himself offensively to kind of drive the offense, but it makes you more one note. And in the playoffs, you don't want to be one note. You want to be adaptable. You want to be changeable. And so while the Grizzlies, they might have found success in game five and nearly had it in game four before that collapse, I think what it does is you don't get the Jaw game, you know, or the three Jaw games in every series where he maybe threatens like a 40 burger or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you don't get those change of pace lineups that come in for like 6 minutes in the third quarter and dominate because it's that change of pace there. You have to play like that the whole game and teams will adjust. They'll find the weak points of that team. And the Warriors may very well do that, not only in game six, but if the Grizzlies somehow got into the next round or whatever, I think if they didn't have Ja, not being adaptable or more versatile, especially offensively, would probably be the death knell for them.
Yeah. I have to agree with that too. And it's just too bad that Ja has this injury. I mean, there's just been a lot of unfortunate injuries in this playoff series or in this whole playoffs this year. And because this team, it really did. I know there's been a lot of Ja Allen Iverson comparisons, but just the like trajectory of this team really did remind me of the 01 76ers, where like they could surprise you and make it to the finals and then get swept. But or they didn't get swept. They won that one overtime game with the step over on Ty Lue, but yeah. Very iconic. But yeah, like they do have that kind of flair to them. And I actually think they're probably more deep than that 76ers team was back then, because I'm like trying to think of other players on that team and I'm drawing a blank. Was there a Hughes? Larry Hughes?
I don't think it was. So there was Dikembe Mutombo.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Allen Iverson. Awesome.
But he was at the tail end of his career, too.
Yeah.
Mutombo.
There was McKee. There was Eric Snow, the big white guy, I believe, right? Like, wait, who's the big tall white guy? I can't remember.
I don't know.
But Steven Adams is a better big tall white guy than that other big tall white guy.
I'm just laughing. If Eric Snow isn't the big tall white guy, that is so funny.
It's Freudian, right? It's Snow. I'm like, well, it's Snow. It's the white guy.
Yeah.
But if that's wrong, that's funny.
Yeah, I love that. That's fine. This podcast is all about being ridiculous anyway. Okay, Samson, we got to talk about the Memphis Grizzlies rally cry, the whoop that trick rally cry at every game. I'm going to assume that everyone listening is about to disagree with me. I don't love it. And that's fine. I'm aware that I'm on an island. I'm all alone. I've limited supplies. I get it. But I don't love it. Because to me, this is going to sound very corny, but I like my rally cries to be positive. Like, hey, team, win. Not, you know what I mean? Is that? And then insert conservative ad. No, I'm kidding.
Do you allow cursing on this show?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I was playing high school sports, there was an opposing town that had a very, very interesting chant. Oh. And it went 1-2, fuck you. 3-4, fuck you. And they would chant it all the time. And it made me laugh really hard being on the opposite end of it. And I thought that was really great, even though it was negative. And I can't think of a positive chant that's affected me in the same way.
Wow. I mean, yeah, you're right. Because they're very into it. Like, they are really, really into it. I guess, like, okay, here is why I don't love the chant. But also, this is, like, hilarious. So, Draymond Green, there's a video of him dancing to it.
Yeah.
At the end of last night's game, right? He's dancing to it. He's getting into it. And then after the game, when he was talking to the media, he said, they not going to whoop that trick alone. We're going to whoop that trick together. And that does not make any sense. I think what happened was Draymond was actually so upset at what was happening that it was like, oh, it will be less upsetting if I join in. So then he tried to join in and make fun of it, make light of it, make it less impactful, which I guess adds to your point that it is impactful. And then at the end was like, no, we're in this together. And it's like, you're not. Like, I think in this scenario, you are the trick. So I don't really understand.
Have you seen Community?
Yes.
Okay,
but not all of it. I can't quote it or anything.
So, you know when Jack Black has his episode where he kind of infiltrates the group?
No, but everyone
okay. listening
will.
Yeah, so Jack Black infiltrates the group and they have a falling out and he says like, well, that's fine. I'll just stay here and study anyway. We'll just be people who are studying in the same room. And they can't really comprehend why somebody would do that. You know, it's like, you're hated here, pal. Like, we don't want you here. And he's like, still, I remain. And maybe that's what Draymond is doing, providing the same energy. He's like, we're all part of it. And they're like, no, we hate you. We see what you do. You know, you had that dirty swim move on Steven Adams just during this game. We don't want to dance with you. But he's like, no, we're all in this together. It's like forced positivity. Is that what Draymond is doing?
I think so. Because, yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying about, like, you know, the NBA needs villains. I completely agree. I think Draymond's a great villain. But that just doesn't make any sense to me at all, because it's like you're making I can't believe I'm about to say this sentence. You're making the trick part of this sentence ambiguous. And why?
If would you be a villain in the NBA? Like, if for fun, do you think you could handle the social media backlash that you would get?
No.
You couldn't lean into it?
I don't think I could. I think I think I care about being well-liked YouTube commenters. No, I'm kidding. as an actor, I love playing villains, but as myself, I think I couldn't handle it personally. But I'll ask you the same question.
Oh, yeah. I'd go full villain. Why not? I mean, it's like, it doesn't actually matter. I was making that, like,
oh, you know what? The money changes things. If I'm like really living it up, then it's like, yeah, who cares? I agree. That adds a bit more of a, yeah.
Like, that's the whole thing about, I wouldn't have social media if it didn't help my writing career, you know, or I guess the content creation is, no, a journalist true. Is now a content creator, whatever the hell that means.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But I wouldn't have social media the way that I do if that wasn't the case. So like, if I was a villain in the NBA, I wouldn't even have social media. I'd just be rich and I'd be like,
you'd be like Dylan Brooks.
Yes, asshattery on the court and then like whatever I want off of it.
Dylan Brooks is like not active on social media. Or power Kawhi move. Leonard is also not active. Yeah, I agree. It is a power move.
Or OG, he lost his check mark on Twitter because he was so inactive. And like he does shit posts for like his ads, right? Like Scotty Barnes, when he had the PS5, he like takes this picture with it and he's like, look, I'm playing with my PS5. It's this whole great thing. Thank you, PlayStation. And OG like took a picture of the box and just put #ad. And like it's incredible. You could just be that guy. You could be villainous and that guy. That's who I would be. An irreverent villain.
I love that. There's not, I was trying to think of like the female equivalent. There's not many WNBA villains. I think there's so much unity in terms of like, we're all in this together. We're all just trying to like prove everyone wrong and maintain relevance. But Diana Taurasi is a real villain. If you've seen Diana Taurasi play. So she lost in the finals last year to the Chicago Sky, Candace Parker's team. And she broke the door in the locker room. I don't know if you know this, Samson.
I know that story.
She broke the door in the locker room, just completely annihilated it. She's also like, I mean, Diana Taurasi, for people who don't know, was named the greatest WNBA player of all time, is I think 39 years old, still playing very hard, 6'1", not the biggest person in the world, completely demolishes this door. And then when they asked her about it, she just said, I don't know. There were a lot of doors in there. That's all she said. And then the Chicago Sky took the broken door and brought it with them to their championship parade, which is incredible. Like, you can't write this stuff. I'm like, man, people need to know more about the WNBA. But anyways, a Diana Taurasi villain would be wonderful for me to be like, but I don't know if I have the guts to even do that.
Could you break down a door?
No, I don't think I'd have to be so enraged. Maybe if I heard enough of the bad political ads on this episode, I could be enraged enough. No, I'd have to be so angry. I couldn't just like in a normal mood. But I mean, losing a championship would be enraging. So maybe mm-hmm. that would be enough for me to break a door. I've never been tested.
What if you were going to win a championship in anything? What do you think it would be in?
In any
or actually lose a championship in anything. You get close, but you end up losing. What is your like? What's your most outstanding skill? What would drive you to door breaking?
Well, screenwriting, because that's my day job. I'm a professional screenwriter. I write for Canadian TV shows,
and I'm very familiar with your work. In fact, I love your work.
Thank you.
I don't know which everything specifically, but yeah, your work is fantastic.
Thank you. I've entered many a screenwriting contest. I've been in the finals of screen contests and lost. But it's so passive because it's just through emails. I'm not like there, like trying to outright someone in the moment. Although I think because I am also a comedian, I would have the improv skills to maybe outright someone in the moment. That would be wild, just to do like a 24-hour, like, here's your premise and go. That would be really fun, actually.
Maybe a 24-minute. Maybe that's something you could do for Rapper's Republic, is you do like a 24-minute impromptu, like, here's what I wrote. I hope you like it. And maybe it's really funny.
And it has nothing to do with the Raptors.
Yeah. Maybe you're her under pressure, you know?
Yeah. Like
you make it happen.
I don't actually write for the website. I just do the pod.
I know, but this could be an expansion of role to embrace your new flex those improvisational skills.
Okay, how about this? One day you give me a topic, right? Like, you know, like when you watch an improv show and then everyone's like, okay, I need a location, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You give me a topic and then...
Wives in the NBA.
Okay. Oh, I need more than 24 minutes for wives in the NBA. I need more than 24 minutes for that. Also, Shaq and Jalen Rose opened up about their divorces at the same time for some reason. Probably a coincidence, maybe not. I mean it was very nice what they, you know, they all said very nice things about their exes, but I was like, weird that both these things came out in the same week.
Dudes rock. That's what I'll say about that. Speaking very nicely of your ex-lover is like dudes rock behavior. Everybody listening out there, if they haven't done a crime to you or something extremely terrible, try to speak kind about people. Do your best.
Amen.
All my ex-lovers, I love you very much. You're very great. Thank you for being a part of my life.
Wow. How did we get there? I do not love all my ex-lovers.
No.
But I guess I wish them well. I can say that much. I do wish them well. But no, I can't say I love them all. It's probably the difference between men and women right there in this new battle of the sexes buckets and as this is evolving. Anyways, okay, so we've talked about that. I don't have much to say about Mav Suns because it's just a series I've been less emotionally invested in, although I am intrigued and I'm a lot more intrigued than I thought I'd be. I am not a believer in the Mavs, but please, Samson, you're the expert here. Tell me what you think of that series, if you have any thoughts at all.
I don't think the Mavs are going to win. Although if they were, it would probably be done via their defense continuing to be a pretty damn good defense. They play small, but they're really gritty at the point of attack. They have some really fun like schematic wrinkles, and they have good defenders at a lot of different positions on the floor, like Jalen Brunson and Dorian Finney-Smith. They have to be able to hide Luka better, or Luka needs to just... We talked about Ja being kind of a bad at the point of attack on defense. Chris Paul bringing out the binoculars and searching for Luka on every possession is not good for the Mavericks, so they kind of have to find a way around that, and Luka has to pair that with just sensational offensive games. I don't think all of that is going to happen. The Suns, as they have been for I guess almost like two full years at this point, right, a well-oiled machine. They play one of the cleanest, tightest versions of basketball in the NBA. They have so many people listen to this podcast probably very familiar with the Raptors. The Raptors have a read and react offensive style, and so there's not that much framework or structure in it. They just want guys to go out there and make these live reads. The Suns have a lot of framework. They run a lot of set actions, and they run a lot of great set actions. Everybody knows where they're supposed to be. Their secondary reads out of them are great, and it's proving quite a bit of times to be too much for the Mavericks to keep up with, especially with like DeAndre Ayton, Mikal Bridges, and then Chris Paul and Devin Booker, of course. So the Suns are just a really strong team. If we get a rematch in the finals, I don't think they beat the Bucks, but I think they're certainly strong enough to get there again. And unfortunately, I don't think the Mavericks are going to beat them as the underdogs.
Yeah, that's right. I also predicted the Suns and Bucks as a rematch in the finals, but I picked the Suns to win. Because, I mean, but I love the two of them becoming this, like, friendly rivalry. But I picked the Suns to win because, I don't know, it's just more of a gut thing, really. Just in that I think Chris Paul's window is going to get even shorter. I think there's more urgency. Like, it's really now where I think the Milwaukee Bucks are built to be here for much longer. And home court advantage, there's also that. Although I think they had it last year too. Like last year, I remember the Suns, after they won the Western Conference Finals, were parading around town with a Western Conference Championship trophy. And I was like, you're going to lose because you're celebrating too early. Like you're going to lose. That was the moment I knew they were going to lose. And then that turned out to be right. And it reminds me of like the San Antonio Spurs, like when they lost in such a devastating way and then they came back the following year and won, I just felt like, oh, I could see that happening more than I could see the Bucks winning back to back. But of course, like, anything could happen.
Giannis is incorrigible. You know, he does things his own way. He is unflappable. Like when they were down to, I think it was the Nets, and both to the Nets and to the Suns, because they were down 2-0 in the finals last year. And that video of Giannis came out where he's like, I've been through it all, man. I airball free throws. I miss shots. I do whatever. It's like, he is not afraid of failure. And that makes him very equipped to succeed. I feel like you absolutely just can't shake him.
And, he also loves his wife.
And he loves his wife. That's right. Okay. Like, see?
It's all coming together.
The Bucks are just a bunch of wife guys. Even Brooke Lopez is married to Disneyland. You know, like he loves it there.
They have a couple cute assistant coaches who I don't even know their names, but I've just noticed.
You love coaches.
I love coaches.
You're a little coach watcher.
I'm a coach watcher. Because in my mind, they're more attainable.
Wait. Did that start with Nick Nurse, or have you always been a coach?
No, it started with Nick Nurse. Ime Udoka is hot.
Oh, that's a handsome guy.
He is a hot, yeah.
Eric Spoelstra is also handsome.
He doesn't do it for me, but I respect it.
He's so fit.
Fit, but he's also too, he's a bit too stiff.
That's because he's got washboard abs holding him upright, you know? Like, the Heat have a very militaristic franchise where they're like,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure quite a few different players have signed there with clauses in their contract that they get like under 8% body fat or something.
That's real.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how Kyle Lowry passes. I feel like there must be an exception for Kyle.
And I'm not
body shaming Kyle. I love Kyle.
Great body, Kyle. Keep doing your thing.
Yeah.
But with Kyle, I think they probably just like, you know what? The talent to fitness parameters are fine. We'll let it. But with Dion Waiters, they're like, you know what? You're going to have to like get super cut, super lean, maybe.
Yeah. He goes to the Weight Watchers meeting, but he doesn't go to the weigh-in.
Right.
Basically.
He's aware of it. He knows what's going on. I get it, guys. I get it. But when it comes time, he's going to be there. Yeah. Totally.
Okay, speaking of players who love their wives, there's a whole new category that we need to discuss, and that's players who love their moms.
Mm.
And that is a very terrible segue to talk about Chris Paul and what happened this week at the game. I mean, there's no opinion to be had on this. I mean, people just need to respect boundaries. I don't know why people don't. It's silly, it's stupid, but it's happening more, and I think it's actually because of social media. Mm-hmm. I think people are literally doing these things to go viral, and it's working, which is pretty scary, actually. Not, I don't want to give people ideas here listening or anything, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I don't want to be like old guy yells at cloud, but there are social norms that are kind of degrading, and the way that we interact is also changed a lot by social media too. And the way that a lot of interactions in the world, the complete history of humanity, are enforced passively by the physicality of the situation. It's like, mm-hmm. there's something that will happen if you act in a certain way. And those barriers are very much changing because a lot of people have grown up with social media and that you get to say a lot of things to people without that physical aspect. And then that carries over into real life. Until the very point that they feel that there is a stopping point to like asshattery. You know, you can only do so much before something comes back your way. And there's a lot more people willing to test that, I assume, which mm-hmm. is not completely social media's fault, but it no doubt plays a part. So yeah, like young kids kind of like banging around, pushing moms. I'm like, damn, I guess I'm a young kid too, but like, I don't know, man. It's kind of wild. You shouldn't be pushing moms. That blows my mind. Just as like a rule of thumb, listener, viewer, don't push moms. Try your best not to.
I mean, like, the discourse around it was so odd because people kept saying like, no one should be allowed to touch players' families, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you're actually not supposed to touch anybody. Like, I don't know why we're relegating this to just players' families. Like, don't touch other people at the stadium, maybe.
That creates a really fun like duality, right? Because it's like, listen, this special class of people you do not touch, but if you have the unfortunate luck of being in the crowd next to somebody you don't know and you're opposite genders, they're going to say, here's the kiss cam, now kiss.
Which, man.
Just really funny. That's obviously not a thing anymore with
kiss
COVID
cam
happening.
With COVID, yeah.
Yeah. But,
I feel like I've seen it not in Toronto.
Wow.
But I feel like other places are doing it still. That's not confirmed. But I feel like I've seen it.
A cultural tour de force. If people are still doing kiss cams, there's like a deep cultural tie.
Because I mean, there's like people who just don't like care or believe in the pandemic.
The last bastion of romance.
I went
in America.
To an NCAA game in Buffalo this year, and it's, you know, you're in a stadium, all that. We had to like get tested. We were, mm-hmm. you know, negative for COVID and all that. I was the only person wearing a mask.
So you couldn't kiss anybody.
Oh, so I couldn't kiss anybody. Which was deeply unfortunate. No, but really, like I was the only one wearing a mask. And then it was like, you get a lot of looks from people. So then there's like this pure pressure to then not wear your mask. And then I think it's like, there's that. I mean, I didn't care, but like there's that whole layer to it too. So I think the kiss cam might be back. The worst part of the kiss cam is I went to a game once with my brother, and my brother and I don't look anything alike because we're both like, we're biracial, like we're half white, half South Asian, and I look more white and he looks more South Asian. So it was just like, you know, I look more like my mom, he looks more like my dad. But it's like, oh, people would think we're a couple because we don't look related. And when that kiss cam came on, I was like leaning over to the stranger next to
me.
You
got kiss cam.
No, we didn't get kiss cam, but I was so scared of getting kiss cam that I was leaning into the stranger next to me, which was very awkward. And I just said, don't touch people in the stadium. But I was leaning into the stranger next to me, just so we wouldn't get caught. Like I was just doing everything I could with my body language to be like, do not put that camera on us.
Yeah, that makes sense. I understand like the hesitancy there. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Thank you.
But moms, I guess. Are we still on? Are we still talking?
Yeah, let's go. Yeah, let's go back to that. Yeah.
Okay. Chris Paul has a mom. He loves his mom. Don't push moms. Oh, is there, do we have another, are there other mom things that you want to talk about?
Like NBA moms?
Yeah.
I think the most iconic NBA mom is Kevin Durant's mom.
Mm-hmm.
She's the real MVP. I think she's like on the Mount Rushmore of NBA moms.
Yeah. Reggie Miller. Well, no, not Reggie Miller. But who's JaVale McGee, his mom.
Oh, yeah.
She's
a former
good
player.
Yeah, pretty good mom. There's a Kyle Lowry's mom in Shrine.
Oh, yes.
Big shout out. Blessed mom.
Marie Holloway.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Can I actually tell a funny story? So
please, we're off the rails 10 times over.
So I tweeted out that Jimmy Butler and Kyle Lowry are motherfuckers in like the best way. And it got like quite a bit of traction because everybody's like, yeah, when I look at Jimmy, when I look at Kyle, like those are motherfuckers. And his mom responded to the tweet and was like, what do you mean by this? And I was like, only in the best way. Like, I promise. It's like, it's
what
a very positive
thing.
What do you
mean thing. By this?
Yeah. I was like, no, like, wow. You get it. Yeah, it's kind of funny. But then she started responding to more of my positive Kyle tweets. Well, I basically only have positive Kyle tweets, but she seemed to be.
She's on top of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I miss her tweeting at all our games. That was really fun. Yeah. I mean, Raptor moms is a whole thing, but like Kem Birch's mom, I think, is fairly active on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Big shout out to the moms.
Yeah. You know, one day, like, we'll do like an off season thing and let's just like do the most inappropriate thing ever and rank people's moms. The Okay, great. Love that. Love that for us. Okay. All right, let's move on to our Raptors homer moment. And Samson, I wanted to ask you about these trade rumors around. Oh, we didn't even talk about the MVP. It's fine. Do you want to say anything about the MVP, about Nikola Jokic winning MVP? And we didn't even talk about this Heat Sixers series at all. I just think it's over, basically.
You got the Heat. That's what you're feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely skipped over it. That's how irrelevant it feels to me. I feel kind of bad saying
that. You know, it's your podcast. Like you move through it the way that you want to.
I don't know. This maybe I'll get some real 76ers fans in here. Probably not. Nikola Jokic winning MVP ended up being a little more controversial than I thought it would be. Like the outrage on Twitter was not expecting. I'm like, he was basically a favorite like all year long. His numbers are very comparable to Joel Embiid. They're almost exact. Same with the team win losses. And I think what it came down, I mean, Joel Embiid had this little bit of a quote about narratives, which I actually think is true. Like, I just think people didn't want to reward the Sixers for just how messy things were with them all year round, which actually, you know, isn't necessarily fair. It has nothing to do with Joel Embiid. Necessarily, but that's what I think happened. And I think Nikola Jokic, he had the quote unquote narrative of doing more with less. Also, you know, I'm a bit of a Western Conference, not elitist, but like it's harder to play in the Western Conference. So when you have X number of wins in the West, those to me, that's objectively harder than getting that same number of wins in the East. People might disagree with that, but that's how I feel. So I think he wins it, not by a lot, but I think he wins it. I think people are mad at Jokic for winning it this year because he didn't do a lot in the playoffs. But people felt that way about Giannis when he won back-to-back MVPs. And people were like, oh, he's not doing enough in the playoffs. He's not cutting it. And then the next year he won a championship and everybody forgot they ever said that.
Yeah, everybody. But that's the thing, right? Actually, I had a tweet about this yesterday where I said, you know, everybody's like, oh, yeah, this guy can't do it. This guy can't do it. And then they get better teammates and they do it. Like, you know, like we talked about Drew Holiday, wife guys, big shout out, you know, Drew. But Drew joined the team. Their point of attack defense got better than when they had Eric Bledsoe. The offense got better than when they had Eric Bledsoe and Drew. Drew's a better player than, you know, Eric. And that was reflected in the trade package for each. But having a better team was pretty meaningful. And, like, that will apply to Nikola Jokic whenever Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. and they have a healthy team. They'll threaten the finals because Nikola Jokic is an MVP-level player. I probably would have given it to Joel. Actually, I do think, as you said, like, the messiness of the Sixers probably took away from it, which is silly. And, you know, Joel Embiid is correct to point to narrative. But I'm totally fine with Jokic getting it. I just...
They're so similar when you look at like all their stats. They're so similar that I'm like, why are people like mad about it? I don't know.
Well, it was kind of like the Scottie Barnes thing too. I'm really glad that Scottie won because, you know, he wanted to win and Scottie's like a sweet kid and he wanted to win. So glad he won. But it's, you know, it didn't really matter if he won. Like fan bases get really attached to seeing their players validated in media or in like the discourse. And it doesn't actually really matter that much. Like, you just want your team to, like, go play basketball. Hopefully it's entertaining, and hopefully they win games. And Scottie was doing that. And Scottie went into the playoffs, and, like, Cade and Evan Mobley didn't, for example. Or Franz Wagner, sorry. And so, like, yeah, Scottie being in the playoffs was way better than, you know, if he had won Rookie of the Year on, like, the ninth seed or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of players throughout like NBA history that only have one or two MVPs, but you could say they were the best player in the league for maybe 6 years in a row. So I think that's just kind of like what happens. It's like the league just kind of likes to share the wealth a little bit there.
There's a lot going on, and people have different ideas of what MVP is. And you know, Embiid wasn't even really close in the voting. Like, I think it was, 69 to, 25 or something in first place votes. It was not close.
Might have that, or I did have that.
Pull it up.
I had it in front of me, and now I don't. Why is that the case? Stupid Bleacher Report. Oh, here it was. It was a link to a tweet, and then it went away, and now it's back. So Nikola Jokic had 65 of first place votes, and Joel Embiid had 26. And Giannis had 9.
Yeah, Giannis wasn't close.
Yeah, no one else had a first place vote. Devin Booker and Luka Doncic both have 1 second place vote.
I disagree with that Devin Booker vote quite heavily. I don't know who voted that, but I disagree with them. Probably about a lot of basketball things.
I don't know. Probably Hubie Brown. okay, so that's that. Let's finally move on to our Raptors homer moment. There's been a lot of trade rumors centered around Rudy Gobert. You know, it's been anticipated for a long time now that the Jazz are going to blow things up, and it's likely that they would keep Donovan Mitchell over Rudy Gobert because he just seems more like the type of player they'd want to build around. Would you want Rudy Gobert to be on the Raptors? And if you did, what would that trade look like for you?
Hell yeah. I mean, especially if a guy is not as well liked within an organization, if you have an idea that you may be able to trade less than what most people would actually want, because Rudy Gobert is on a huge contract, a massive one. That's part of the appeal for them to trade him to move off of the contract. But he didn't win Defensive Player of the Year. That doesn't mean he's any worse at defense than the years he did win it. He just didn't win it this year. There's voter fatigue for that. Like, he has 3 already. He is a tremendous, tremendous defender. He's an incredible role threat. And if the Raptors had him on their team, they would be significantly better on offense and defense. Like, that's Rudy Gobert is a really great player, and there are limitations that he has that you wish, like, he should be able to get the ball thrown into him in the post, and he should be able to go get you a bucket on occasion, and he can't. But limitations exist in a bunch of different players. We've been talking about Ja Morant, and we've been talking about star player Luka, who can't defend. And Rudy Gobert, he can't score as a main option, or maybe even the second or third option in the half court setting without being assisted. But the Raptors have, like, everybody isolates and everybody creates on their own anyway. They have a team of guys who are willing to put the ball on the floor. So Rudy wouldn't really feel that pressure. He would just really beef up their offensive rebounding, really beef up their defense, and he would catch a lot of lobs and a lot of rim runs and stuff like that. So he would be awesome on the Raptors.
It kind of reminds me, I was just going to comment on that a bit. It kind of reminds me a little bit, not that they're the same player at all, but it reminds me a little bit of Marc Gasol, right? Like, he was not a scoring threat when he was out there pretty much at all. Like, I don't think he was averaging quite 10 points a game, but he was extremely useful. He had great passing. I actually don't know how Rudy Gobert's passing holds up. It's just so-so. But
maybe even worse than Sosto, but that doesn't matter that much. But
I mean, I was so going to say that we have experience with a center that isn't necessarily a primary scoring option, was what I was trying to say. But anyway, maybe that point is not so good.
No, that's a good point. It's, but that's totally it. Is like the way your team is built affects how players who come in, you know, operate in it. Precious Achiuwa being able to put the ball on the floor against the 76ers became more important because of Fred VanVleet's injury. And, you know, that's the way that the 76ers loaded up on Pascal Siakam for a couple games. It meant that OG Anunoby had, like, a couple really big pop-off games. And so everything compounds, and these things are all tied together. And Rudy Gobert, the strengths in his game, I think, and the weaknesses fit into the Raptors in a way that his strengths will be maximized and his weaknesses will kind of be papered over. And that's especially if somebody is like can be had for less than what they normally would. I think that creates like the terms for a really interesting guy to go after in a trade. The rumors say that the Raptors are interested, but the framework that would get you there is presumably you're looking at like either Fred, Gary, or OG or Pascal, I guess. And you have to make your bones with what you think Rudy is worth. Like, because we're talking about hypothetically, we're talking about it, you and I, we don't actually have any bearing on what the Raptors want to do, who they value highest or whatever. I would assume that Pascal is they view him as maybe a better player or an equal player to Rudy at this time, so they wouldn't make that trade. And he's on a smaller contract, I guess, as well. Gary, maybe they view him as a guy who's valued higher. I think Gary is valued higher than how good he is currently, which isn't a slight. I mean, maybe it's just a good year. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Gary will continue to improve and get better and better. But I would presume that Gary or OG would be the center of a package over there. And that's just because Fred seems so essential to the culture of the team that I struggle to see them moving on from him. But one of Gary or OG. And I would assume the Jazz probably value OG a fair bit higher than they do Gary. But I would probably try and build a package around Gary. But I also don't think that the Jazz would accept that, unfortunately. It's tough to trade, you know, for big guys.
Yeah, that's interesting because I wonder, oh, this is going to be a controversial statement. I wonder if OG and OB has fallen out of what we would consider our core.
I hope not. Do you think so?
No, not necessarily. Because I love OG, but I'm just saying I wonder. Because, you know, we started the season by being like, you know, Fred, Pascal, OG, those are our three guys we're rolling with. But then Scotty Barnes ascends way faster than we thought he would. And now, like, you wouldn't necessarily say OG is a top three player on the team necessarily. And then that would make him a bit more expendable, perhaps.
I still think OG is better than Scotty, but I think you're onto something as far as like thinking about heading forward. How long till Scotty is better than OG? You know, right. does he get there? At what point does he get there? And this is something that, like, as far as in basketball on the court, OG, his types of possessions that he got squeezed a little bit because Pascal had an all NBA year. He got a lot of possessions and he did great things with them. And Scotty had a rookie of the year season where he got a lot of possessions to try things out. And both of them scaled accordingly and got better and better as the season went on. OG's possessions started out getting just a ton of stuff to try out in the start of the season. They had injury trouble, and then he had to adjust to the changing landscape of the team. And his play style got squeezed a little bit as far as trending towards the star version of himself. And he was playing more like a, not a role player, but a tertiary guy. And so I would really want to keep OG just because of, you know, the defense, the three-point shooting, the latent on-ball abilities, let's say. But I understand why somebody would view him as having less, appeal than some other guys in the front office because he didn't have as big a year as a lot of other notable players. Like Fred being injured, he was an all-star, though. Pascal, whenever they announce all-NBA, I assume will be on the third team. And Scotty won rookie of the year. That's a lot of success surrounding a guy, especially when he had injury troubles and had a middling year as far as what expectations were. So, yeah. But I hope he stays, man. I would be crushed in my heart of hearts if OG went out the door.
I would be, too. I definitely would be, too. Okay, Samson, let's wrap things up here. I usually do a Nick Nurse hottie highlight of the week, but he's in vacation mode, man. And I'm going to be honest, like, I'm not a stalker. I have no updates on Nick Nurse. He's laying low, having a good time. Does he love his wife? Probably. I'm not following her on Instagram, so I don't know.
That's good. I'm glad.
I'm not following her?
I'm always uncomfortable with the tracking of players. Like, I see it pop up on Twitter, and so I passively intake that stuff. But yeah. I cannot go searching like that.
No, it's too much.
It feels like too much, yeah.
I do have friends who are very active online, just generally very active. And if something comes up, they usually send me an alert. So I like low key have these like free researchers help me. But I didn't have anything this week. So that's that. Let's call it there. Samson, thanks so much for joining me this week. Let people know where can people find you on the internets.
Hopefully my name is unique enough that you just type in Samson Folk. And hopefully it turns something up. Because I don't have a common name, you know? Like, my name isn't, like, Dave McDavid or something, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, hopefully
shout out to all the Dave McDavids listening.
Yeah. Oh, I guess I didn't even make my name. Just type
on YouTube,
in...
no, but that's fine.
Yeah. Just type in my name and hopefully, like, my Twitter or my author page or something comes up. And
yeah, I feel like you tweet pretty frequently, which is great.
So every once in a while, I'll do this thing where I calculate the amount of days that I've been or somebody I know has been on Twitter, and then I'll divide it by their amount of tweets, and just to see how many, like, on average a person tweets per day. And I think since, like, 2014, I'm on average, like, 6 maybe tweets per day, which is obviously game days I tweet a lot because I'm live tweeting games, and then you have to publish pieces and all that kind of stuff. But otherwise, I definitely tweet more than you, but
wow.
But as far as, like, I'm in the middle ground.
You definitely tweet more than me. Yeah,
I'm in the middle. Well, that's not a slight. As I said, like, at the start of the podcast, I wish I didn't have to tweet. But I have, like, the medium brain worms where I'm tweeting too much probably, but it's not like, oh my God, dude, get off the internet, please. Like, not every thought you have is for consumption. I haven't reached that point, and I hope I never do. But yeah, if somebody after I said all this wants to
still
go
follow
me, yeah,
well, I'm sure everyone listening is already following you probably. But no, that's hilarious. I love that you're getting your own analytics. You're just like doing it on your own. Somehow you've like, you have an Excel sheet, you have formulas, you're just like old school building up your own analytics. Really wonderful detail about you that we all got to learn.
Yeah. Neurosis is what it's referred to, I believe.
Thanks everyone for listening to this wild episode. I definitely had a lot of fun. If you want to follow me, I obviously tweet less. You can follow me at @itsme_Catherine, spelled CATHRYN. We'll be back next week. I'm going to be covering the NBA throughout, maybe even some draft and free agency stuff. Well, we'll be here all summer. So thanks again for supporting the show, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.